Welcome to our panel on software patents. And the question we're posing is, are they great, dangerous, or pointless? I hate to disappoint you, but we're not going to have a solid answer. Our panelists today are Julie Samuels from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She's done a lot of work on patent issues there. And Laura Seidel from National Public Radio, who's done a lot of reporting on the patent issue, including one of the most downloaded, I believe, episodes of This American Life. And I'm a patent attorney with a law firm, Foley & Lardner, working in Chicago and Boston. So we're going to start the panel off with Julie. Oh, actually, before we get to that, I have a disclaimer that the views expressed in this panel are my own individual views. They're not the views of the law firm I work for, nor is it an endorsement of the views of my fellow panelists. More audio.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So before Julie gets to that, one view of the patent system is well exposed in this little infographic that I have here of the bad, evil patent attorney man with his bag of patents attacking the poor innovator on the right with his golden coins.
Oh, there I am. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. I'm going to start by giving a very high-level, quick history of software patents, just so we're on the same page. If you want to ask later, we can go into a little more detail, but I don't think that's really the point of today. For those of you who aren't familiar with EFF, you might not know that I'm not the biggest fan of software patents, so take that for what it's worth as I get talking. Before the 1980s, there were no software patents. In 1981, that was the first time the Supreme Court kind of said, okay, you can maybe patent something that has software involved. And then in 1998, the Federal Circuit, in a pretty famous case called State Street Bank, allowed a party to patent a business method. It was a system for dealing with mutual funds. And these business methods, as opposed to a, you know, tangible invention, something you can probably hold in your hand or some kind of machine, now all of a sudden we could patent these business methods. And in many instances, those business methods include software. So again, that was 1998. Then fast forward to 2010. I'm sure many of you have heard of the Bilski case. This was another case involving a business method patent. This one was about hedging risk, and everyone was involved. You know, all the players filed briefs the whole way up. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court issued this really convoluted opinion that totally muddled the waters and said, you know, these patents are okay, and there are all these different tests, but sometimes they're not okay, and it's just been a train wreck ever since then as we try and figure out where the courts want folks to go. There's one other thing I meant to say earlier, and that's in the 80s and the 90s when these patents, software patents, were first becoming popular. All of the big software companies, for the most part, were anti-software patents, which is interesting. Now, you know, most of them are on board getting patents, being involved in patent lawsuits, etc. But early on, folks were not so interested. So the next thing I'm going to talk about is the Constitution. And Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution actually talks about patents and copyrights. And there it is. To promote progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors exclusive right to promote their respective writings and discoveries. And there's something really important here. And it's the first couple words, which say, to promote the progress of science. And I think part of the problem with the patent system today, particularly with software patents, actually I'm only really talking about software patents right now, is that they're not promoting progress of science, right? So the progress of science, I think you have to take to mean for the betterment of society, for innovation, et cetera. And you know, on the ground, that's not what we're seeing happening. And part of the problem, I think, that led to that is that the patent system, which is largely a one-size-fits-all system, doesn't make so much sense when you start talking about software. And, you know, this now, obviously, we're a little bit more into my opinion, but there are a couple of reasons why I think that's the case. And I think these are some policy concerns that we should keep in mind as we go forward in our conversation today and as a society, how we think about software patents going forward. First of all, the patent system is set up as a bargain. You're an inventor. You invent something new. You get a 20-year monopoly to exploit that. But in return, you have to dedicate that invention to society. So after 20 years, we can all use it and build upon it and make it better and promote the progress of science. But that's really not been working well and when it comes to software for a host of reasons. And one of the big problems is the notice provision of patents, which means that someone who's skilled in the art of the relevant patent, so let's say you're a software engineer, you can read a patent on software, in theory, and get an idea of what the patent covers. That's the theory. But if any of you have ever looked at a patent and read the claims of a patent, you'll know they're notoriously difficult to understand. And I know Laura's going to talk a little bit more about that, so I will defer to her. But I think that's a fundamental problem. The time of a patent, 20 years, the life of a patent, I should say, 20 years doesn't seem to make sense for software. The technology moves way too quickly. It can take years. It often takes years to get a patent through the patent office, an application through the patent office. And by the time you've got a patent, your business model could likely be obsolete because there's another product out there. You know, you're all here at South By, I'm sure you know how quickly that moves. Software is also particularly situated as a building block technology. I write some code, you code on top of it, and it's better. But if I have a patent on the code I wrote on the software, then you actually can't use it, even for testing purposes in most cases. So that's a problem, and I think that's a problem that really has implications for society at large. Unless you pay. And that is actually a perfect segue to what we've seen is the biggest problem, I think, and that is the cottage industry of litigation that surrounds software patents. I'm mostly worried about the patent trolls, of course, but it's not just the trolls. I mean, yesterday, Yahoo sued Facebook over 10 patents, and there is an entire industry devoted to this litigation. And it's particularly bad with regard to software. Lawsuits surrounding software patents have gone up 3 times since 1999 and currently make up more than a quarter of all patent litigation. There's a bunch of reasons this is the case. Like I said, patents that cover software tend to be broad and vague. Also, in the 90s, when software patents were new, companies were just building up their arsenal of patents to use both defensively and offensively. And so now you've got a whole bunch of crappy patents floating around, and businesses, notoriously Kodak, maybe IBM, and some others, when they start maybe not doing so well in business or otherwise perhaps are losing money, and they go to monetize what they still own, all of a sudden they own these patents, and they sell them off to the highest bidder. And in many instances, the highest bidder is a troll who just starts suing. And this has had a really, really negative effect. It's driving companies from the U.S. We've seen reports. It's driving businesses out of business because they face these awful choices where they either need to litigate in federal court, which can cost well into the $1 million easily, or they have to take a license in order to move their business forward. And it's become essentially a tax on innovation. So, you know, Spotify is a great example. Spotify comes to the United States. 2 weeks later, you know, patent lawsuit on their doorstep. Welcome to America, Spotify. We sue you. So this is the kind of thing that we're really worried about. That's kind of the background on software patents. From my perspective, so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over, but I'm happy to talk about some of the stuff EFF is doing later during questions to kind of combat this, but it's a big problem.
How many people here are software engineers? I'm just curious. Okay. And how many people in here are entrepreneurs? All right. Well, I'm a journalist, and I live in San Francisco, and I had been hearing from various people little stories about problems in the system. And I one day had a conversation with a guy named Alex Bloomberg, who works with Planet Money. He was in town, and we started talking about these things I was hearing about patents. And we ended up looking into it, and I was going to do a couple pieces, and it ended up becoming an hour-long This American Life. Because what we found, we were kind of amazed by what we found, and it kept getting bigger. I first, you know, in terms of if you're software engineers, I went out, I kept hearing not very good things about patents from the inventors. And what I was discovering, for one thing, was that the inventors, the people that the Constitution is meant to encourage, seem to be very unhappy about the system. And as far as I could tell, the only people who seemed to be defending it were the lawyers. And I, you know, sorry.
It's okay.
I want to play a little bit of tape. I'm just going to start with this because I think this kind of brings it home. And this, I want to tell you, this was, I randomly went to South Park in San Francisco, which is a place where a lot of people who work, you know, as software programmers have lunch. I just went there one day. I was not looking. I just, and I'm going to play you this tape. What about, if I say patent system, what do you say?
I think it's just a way for lawyers to make money, and it's basically it's a killer for creativity.
Complicated, broken.
It's basically a flim-flam game that anybody who knows how to take advantage of it is doing.
Do you kind of groan when you hear the word?
I do, yeah. You want to hear a groan for the radio?
Yeah, let's hear a groan.
Grrr.
To say, I actually worked on a whole bunch of patents in my career over the years, and I have to say that every single patent is nothing but crap.
This is Stefan Brunner, a programmer. He said something we heard from a lot of software engineers. His software patents don't even make sense to him.
I can't tell you for the hell of it what they're actually supposed to do and what they, because I did not. The company said, we have to do a patent on this, and then they sent in a lawyer, and they basically... You basically say, ah, that's probably right, that's probably wrong, and it's just like write something that makes no sense. And I personally, when I look at them, I'm not proud at all, because most of them, again, it's just like mumbo jumbo, which nobody understands, and which makes no sense from an engineering standpoint whatsoever.
Stefan?
So, you know, and we went and we found this guy's patent, and I guess, can you guys hear? I'm not sure how well you can hear. Can you hear it? Because I'm going to let, no, is it like, is it worth playing Alex actually reading from the patent so that you can hear what this his patent, Stefan Brunner's patent? Yeah, okay.
Jeff? Jeff's clip?
What was this? No,
oh, sorry. Let's
just continue on with that. What about, if I say patent?
A lot of software engineers. His to him.
I can't tell you for the hell of it.
Sorry.
I choose another one.
And what they're actually supposed to do, and what they, because I did not. The company said we have to do a patent on this, and then they send in a lawyer, and they basically, you basically say, ah, that's probably right, that's probably wrong, and it's just like write something that makes no sense. And I personally, when I look at them, I'm not proud at all, because most of them, again, it's just like mumbo jumbo, which nobody...
Here it is, sorry about that.
Which makes no sense from an engineering standpoint whatsoever.
Stefan Brunner, patent 7650296, quote, a configurator using structure and rules to provide a user interface. One sample section, and trust me, the whole thing is like this. According to one embodiment of the invention, a customizable product class is created. A component product class is added to the customizable product class, where the component product class is a subclass of the customizable product.
Can I really quickly make a quick plug for this episode of This American Life? If you have not taken the hour to listen to it, it's called When Patents Attack. I have to tell you, I've been doing this work for some time, and this explains it better than anything I've ever written or said, and most other people. So, you know, go to, I guess, npr.org or whatever.
Well, This American Life.
This American Life.
The July 22nd episode. But, I mean, you get the idea, and this is what we saw. And then we heard about these things called patent trolls, and these were, Julie kind of talked about it, these companies that seem to go around suing everybody. And I kind of liked the name. You know, as a journalist, it sounds kind of sexy, right? You know, a patent troll. What on earth is a patent troll? And Alex said to me, well, you know, usually when people are going about doing these things, they don't think of themselves as evil. They have reasons for doing what they're doing. Why don't you call up a patent troll and go talk to one? And so we ended up talking to a company called Intellectual Ventures. Have any of you heard of them? Which was founded by Nathan Myhrvold, the former CTO of Microsoft. And of course, he did justify what he was doing. He said, we are helping to support invention. That is what we were doing. We are making sure, you know, inventors, you guys, you're like artists. You don't really know how to look after yourselves. And so you need somebody to represent your interests, because big bad people come along, steal your ideas, and you don't make any money. So what we do, we go, we give you some money. This is Nathan Mirville talking, and we help encourage you to go out there and invent and invent and invent. He gave us an example of somebody, a guy named Chris Crawford, who supposedly invented, cloud computing. And he did this in the 90s, mid-90s, before I think we even understood what modern cloud computing was. Turned out they had sold, they didn't realize, they kind of goofed. They gave us the wrong guy because they had sold this patent, and it turned out they'd sold it to a real live patent troll. When we went down to Texas, which is the center of these patent troll suits, we went and we tried to find this company called Oasis Research that was suing, you know, I mean, like a couple dozen companies with this patent. We never spoke, we never found Chris Crawford, ever. He would never return my calls. I even talked to his brother, this inventor that they had supposedly helped. But his patent was being used all over the place to sue all kinds of people. And I guess, you know, on the one hand, you could say, well, this is it a victimless crime? You know, it's just a bunch of big guys throwing money around. The problem is for you who are out there who want to go start your own companies. It has reached the point, and this is what we began to see, where I think it becomes impossible to develop anything in software without stepping on somebody. And so what happens is you go out there and suddenly your company's doing well, and one day you wake up and there's some paper at your door, and it's somebody saying either pay up or we're going to shut you down. And this is going to be a segue into Ruben. I'm going to play you some tape of somebody to whom this happened. And this was somebody, he was living the dream. He actually, I think he was in Dallas with his buddies. He started a photo sharing site. You know, back in the day, they did the whole weekend and nights. They worked hard. They started up their company. And then all of a sudden, he gets that letter. And here we go. This is him.
What was especially galling to Jeff when he called him to ask, what am I stealing from you guys? They wouldn't tell him.
That was a question they wouldn't answer. They said they wouldn't answer that until we got into court. So they wouldn't even identify what parts of our business or what they thought we were doing to use their technology.
But to go to court, to answer that question, was going to cost money, a lot of money.
It was between $2 and $5 million. And that's more than our company can handle, honestly. We knew we had to settle this thing somehow. There would be no more photo time today if we had to do that.
Jeff felt like he had no choice but to settle. He told Gar and Alex that reaching a settlement ended up taking 6 months, very rough 6 months.
It feels like if they're not reasonable, okay, our venture of 10 years is going to be gone. They have to be reasonable or we will just plain be gone. And we're talking about 10 years of our life. You know, honestly, as I'm talking about it now, it's kind of raising my heartbeat a little bit, because I just remember how I personally felt, just the huge amount of anxiety and lack of control over the whole situation. It was just an awful feeling.
Can I ask what that final settlement was, how much it was?
No. Unfortunately, part of the terms of our settlement agreement is that we don't discuss the amount.
Did it put your business in danger?
It did, and they knew that. The settlement they wanted to get was just enough to put us in danger, but not to close us. And I'll stop there.
So I, you know, without further ado, you're going to talk a little bit about what it's like for some of the people doing business.
I want to talk a little bit about sort of the patent system generally and some of the issues that have been brought up. I'm not going to be a huge defender of the status quo. I think to say that the patent system is perfect would be disingenuous and kind of stupid. But one thing I do want to address about is talk about some of the problems. One particular problem I think comes up a lot is what I kind of frame as the bad patent bubble. In the 1990s, a lot of software patents were applied for. The patent office didn't have experience because, as Julie said, you couldn't get them through the 80s. And you have a lot of stuff that issued that probably is invalid, may be invalid, and it's a mess, and it's not pleasant. The upside to that is that nowadays, I think it's a lot harder to get the sort of ridiculous patents you could get in the 90s issued. That said, that doesn't mean every patent that issues is perfect. I mean, a lot of litigation is, in fact, trying to show that a patent is really invalid. The other issues that I just want to touch upon real quickly, because one thing I want to do is get to the Q&A portion of today's talk, is litigation arbitrage, which is an issue that both Julie and Laura talked about. You have a lot of actors who may know that they have a patent that's just, like, totally bogus, but they don't care. They know that if they file a lawsuit, the judge isn't going to dismiss it really quickly and that they can get a really nice settlement amount that's early enough at a price point that's just what someone's willing to maybe pay to make it go away and not have to deal with full litigation and never get sanctioned or anything because the judge just isn't going to make that call that early in a case. Another issue is damages law, which you could spend like an entire day seminar on rather than like 5 minutes in this discussion. But that creates some really quirky incentives when it comes to patent litigation. And there should just never be an incentive to sue a startup. Like, economically, it just doesn't make any sense. But yet, this does happen sometimes, and the incentives are really perverse as to why it does happen. And if you want to talk about it later, come find me. I'll talk about it, but I don't want to get into the details here. So moving on from there, innovation economies are messy and complex. You have a lot of actors, and many different factors contribute to whether your business is going to be successful or not. Your idea, access to capital, your team, your marketing, your market opportunity, your competitors, your timing, your management, your developers, scaling, network effects. You get the idea. There's a lot of stuff at play. And your idea, what you could patent if you wanted to, is only one item of that. So one way I try to conceptualize patents and the justification for their existence is sort of think of them as a business tool. I consider there to be societal value in being first to contribute something to the ether of innovation, and that a patent rewards that contribution. In some ways, it can spark further innovation. It can lead to other people to say, hey, what about doing it this way or doing it that way? And my thought is that a patent does promote innovation by rewarding this sort of race to be first. And Professor Mark Lemley at Stanford has a paper that he wrote last year called The Myth of the Sole Inventor, where he describes how patent races, this is a similar concept, can really lead to some innovation. And one other thing that I want to just mention in this area is that most patents are not litigated. The patents that are talked about, that are publicized, they're the ones that are in litigation because that's public, that's known. The vast majority of patents and patent use on a daily basis, even within our law firm, is really, you know, licensing, doing mergers, valuing them for acquisitions, that sort of thing. It really is sort of a tool to help sort of capture value that's really hard to measure otherwise. And I do want to talk a little bit about the world without software patents. I don't think the world we live in right now and the state of software patents is perfect, but I also don't think we should live in a world that has completely no software patents, because I really do think that sort of gives a free rein to just go out and really do copy other people's ideas. Even if today you're a small business and you don't have a patent, you know, the system exists. There's like an inherent, I don't want to say threat, but threat. There's an inherent threat out there that if you copy someone else's idea or try to just totally usurp their business, that there's something that can be done about it to justify your entry into the market. That's not necessarily true if you got completely rid of software patents. I think you'd see a shift to the sort of more blatant copying of other people's ideas. And I think that's bad for small innovators, especially in software, because the software industry is so dominant by large players who have really strong network effects and entrenched consumers, that it's good for a small innovator to have that system in its back to help it out. And on that note, I do want to shift to sort of what's the practical implications, because I think we all would agree that the patent system is here. It's not changing anytime soon. We can have debates and sort of try to change the law if you want. And, you know, I think a lot more people are interested in this topic. I was kind of surprised we had the big conference room here. And we can take that interest and we can use it to change the system. And if you feel strongly about this, I strongly encourage you to get active on this issue. But some practical issues if you're a startup, and I saw a lot of hands that are entrepreneurs. What if you get sued? First thing to do is talk to your attorney and get them, if they're not a patent attorney, get them to find you a good patent attorney. From my experience, most attorneys are willing to talk to entrepreneurs and startups for free just to figure out what's going on and get you where you want to go. If you can't find one, email me. A strong-worded letter could make it all go away. Back to the litigation arbitrage thing, there are a lot of cases I have seen in my, you know, short few 3.5 years of practice is our cases that are just totally baseless, like surprise and shock that they were ever filed. And if you have a good patent attorney, they can maybe get rid of it with a really strongly worded letter. Unfortunately, that's not all the cases. Some of them might have merit. And you might have to settle for something. And in a worst case scenario, because of those damages incentives I was talking about earlier, they might make you settle for an amount that's not pleasant to you. But they never have an incentive to put you out of business because then they actually can't collect the money. I know that's sort of not a huge saving grace, but it's something to consider. And the other thing to think about is the vast majority of startups aren't getting sued. So, and on the patent acquisition side of things, if you're considering whether you should get a patent, whether you should get into this game, it depends. A good patent can be expensive to get, between $8,000 and $15,000 or more.
Those numbers are not legal fees, though, right? Those are patent office fees.
Those are legal fees, not patent office fees.
All right, because it's usually more than $15,000.
For software, I don't think it depends. For a small company, I think this is an accurate pricing for a small company. If you're a big company doing really complicated stuff, it could get bigger. You could get, I mean, there are. I have seen patent applications that get prosecuted for like $50,000.
Yeah.
So, and it also depends on your investors. Some investors love patents, some absolutely loathe them. Others are totally apathetic. That's a conversation you're going to have to figure out and see if it's important for your investors. And at the end of the day, though, it's your business, and you need to weigh the risks and benefits in light of the technology, the market you're working in, who the other players are. Are you up against someone who's entrenched? What your position is going to be. And if you do decide, okay, let's take a look. Should we get a patent? You want to consider whether it's truly a novel and interesting idea. One thing I do agree with is that, you know, getting a software patent, it should be hard. It should be something that is actually new and interesting. You should consider, you know, valuation, whether it's going to help value your company more or not, and what's your market like I said before. And if you do decide to get a patent, focus on the core, especially if you're a small company that doesn't have a lot of access to capital. Focus on the core of what makes you novel and different.
Can we really quickly, would you mind going back to the slide that says, what if I get sued?
Yes. And Julie, please, if you have other stuff to add.
I do have a couple of things. Yeah. this is the part that really drives me crazy, is there are all these things here. And if you're doing these things, you are not putting your resources and your time and your energy into your business, right? And you're not bettering your project, and you're not using your money to maybe hire more employees or you know, otherwise grow your business. Instead, you know, you're fighting in courts and at the patent office. And that, to me, just really feels like a misallocation of funds. And that's part of what I find so troubling about this. And there's one thing I meant to say earlier that is somewhat relevant, and that in other parts of the world, in sciences, the patent system does seem to make a little bit more sense. There are certain types of inventions that really take a lot of investment and infrastructure in a way, frankly, that software and coding just doesn't. I mean, I'm talking about building factories, developing drugs. If you develop a new drug, you need to take it through 3 rounds of testing at the FDA. Animal, people. This can take years and literally $1 billion. So the incentives for that should not be the same as the incentives for getting a software patent that you can, code in your parents' basement. Or I get that a lot are way more complicated than that, but it's a fundamentally different thing we're talking about. And just two more quick things in response to this. A lot of the costs might not be at the actual lawsuit phase, and I think that our numbers and the data we have are therefore imperfect because so many of the costs happen pre-litigation. You get a scary letter in the mail, you just pay or go out of business or deal with it like Jeff from Photodime dealt with it because you never want to get to litigation. And that happens privately. You don't have to report that. You don't have to file anything in the courts. So we lack in data because of that. So I think the problem is actually a lot more pervasive even than the data suggests. And finally, I wanted to really quickly talk about Lodsis, a particular patent troll who I find to be the most egregious of the patent trolls.
And I believe that was one of the patents that had been an intellectual ventures
patent. Not only had it been an intellectual ventures patent, but as your story made clear, they shared office and address, if you will, with Oasis.
Right. This is so all the weird connections. So this patent that intellectual ventures gave us that we traced to this empty office in Texas that was suing all these people had the exact same address as Lodsis. And it turns out that patent had also been an intellectual ventures patent, and there was this empty office in a row of empty offices in Marshall, Texas.
And Lodsis is really, it's a company owned by this guy named Mark Small. I believe he's in southern Wisconsin, and he's never really spoken to the press on it. He has posted some blog posts, but he's never really spoken to the press, so we haven't really heard his side. But briefly, what Lodsis owns four patents that it got from IV. That's all it does. You know, a key component of the patent troll business model is not to make or sell anything, for the most part. So Lodsis is a prime example of this. And all of a sudden, one day, I believe it was 6 months ago or something, we start hearing that Lodsis is sending these scary letters to iPhone and Android app developers and telling them that they're infringing these two Lodsis patents for in-app upgrades and in-app purchases. You know, you're in the free version of Angry Birds or whatever, and it says, click here to buy the full HD version. That click here, that's the technology we're talking about. What's particularly troubling about this instance is that if you, as many of you know, are operating in the iPhone, you know, in iOS or in the Android system, you have to use that technology that you get from Apple or Google. Now, this is really complicated for a second, but follow me here. Intellectual Ventures owns about 35,000 patents. Many huge companies have taken blanket licenses to all those patents. When you start talking about patents in the 30s of thousands, no one's read them all. So Google takes a blanket license from Ivy, says, you know, there are probably a couple really strong patents in here that we need a license to do our business. But we've got to license the rest of it because that's the cost of doing business. So that license traveled with the Lodsis patents. IV spins off the patents to Lodsis, and now Lodsis can't sue Apple and can't sue Google. And most likely, as part of that license, Google and Apple can't move to invalidate Lodsis's patents, right? I hope I'm not getting to
that. So basically what's going on is that is why Apple can't really defend all its developers, because their hands are tied legally. They can't do anything.
So Google has now filed a re-exam, and I think there might have been a well-placed phone call, because Google happens to be a major investor in IV. But anyway, that's a story for another day that maybe you'd like to follow up on.
Well, actually, what I wanted to follow up on, because it is a room of people who are entrepreneurs, is another side of this, though, to think about in terms of getting a patent, and something that I didn't play. I actually talked that Jeff Kelling, who you heard, I talked to the guy who owned the patent that was used to sue him, and he was actually really upset that that's what happened to his patent.
Right.
He, you know, like a lot of people who found companies, you patent things. If your business doesn't work out, you sell. And maybe you hope that somebody will develop your idea. Unfortunately, his idea, which basically was a core idea about photo sharing, that, you know, could have built Flickr, but didn't. It wound up instead with somebody who used it to sue Flickr when Flickr got successful. And this is a side to it. If, for example, the first story that got me interested in this was an inventor, I can't get into the details, who had invented something while working for somebody else. That company had gone out of business. He wanted to start another business, but he was early. And you know, like sometimes being early is as good as being wrong. He was just too early. But the time had come, but he was having troubles. He was having to step all around his own patent. So it is, I mean, I think it's complicated. You know, if you're starting a business, what is the best course of action for you in terms of using a patent or having a patent? Because a lot of investors want to see you have a patent.
A lot do, but a lot also don't or don't care. So that's something you got to consider when you're evaluating whether to get a patent or not. But when you do make that evaluation, think about it from the interests of your business, not so much from the interests of your investor.
Can I also jump in for a second? There are, potential solutions here. It's not all bad. We EFF is already rolling out some advocacy on this. You can go to EFF.org/patent. And there's going to be more. And I think we can push the system and we can fix the system. And one thing that I'm hoping we'll see in the next couple of months is this academic paper by a couple of professors at Berkeley, and it's going to detail a defensive patent licensing scheme where parties will be able to cross-license essentially, or it's not even cross-license, it's dedicate their patents to this pool of patents, and everyone who wants to dedicate his or her patents will get a license to every other patent in there and won't be able to sue. And that license will travel with the patents. And I guess my larger point, and I'm happy to talk about this in detail or later or come up to me, but my larger point is there are a lot of solutions out there. We've not seen help from Congress at all. We've seen very little help from the courts in fixing these problems. So a lot of people from the activist side of things are trying to come up with new solutions. So, you know, instead of feeling like your hands are tied and you have to get a patent and you have to get a patent to get VC dollars and all of this, there might be other answers. And we are working on them. And I am optimistic, but I think it's going to take a while.
And one thing, actually, that Laura pointed out, the idea that the inventor was surprised what was happening in his patent, I think that's one thing that a lot of people don't realize about the patent system is that when you get a patent, it is a property right like any other type of property. You can assign it, you can transfer it over, and once you do that, you can retain some rights to it, or you can actually give the whole thing piecemeal away, and then you have no other rights to it. And that's something to just keep in mind. Should we move on to Q&A?
I mean, it's the kind of thing that's, because if all of you are software engineers, I don't know, you know, how many of you are right now in the midst of, it sounds like a lot of you are entrepreneurs, you want to start your own company, and so a lot of this stuff is going to be relevant to you. And I think it's a kind of a hard moment. Congress just passed patent reform, but it didn't really address these issues, unfortunately, and I don't know that they will. I mean, I'm not a policy person, I can't come up with solutions, but it is the world right now that you kind of have to live in if you're an inventor, and these guys are probably more helpful on the pragmatic stuff about it, but do people have questions about this?
Also, we asked if there were engineers and entrepreneurs. Are there any patent trolls in the audience? No? Yeah, we should move to questions.
Yeah, you guys can line up at the mic, I think.
Yeah, there's a dartboard over there for the patent troll, if you want to just...
Can we turn on the mic?
Yep.
We're a small startup. We have a content publishing platform, but we work with a lot of Fortune 500 large companies. And I think largely because of these patent lawsuits, the contracts keep coming back with indemnification clauses written in them.
Yep.
And, you know, the idea of us indemnifying, you know, a Fortune 500 company is sort of silly. How would you suggest?
Gotcha.
Can you guys all, could everyone hear that question?
Yeah. Hey, tech folks, can we get the microphones working for the audience?
The question, just to repeat it quickly, was it was about indemnification clauses. So the gentleman has a content distribution platform. A content publishing platform, and they make deals, let's say, with Fortune 500 companies, and the Fortune 500 companies insist the cost of doing business is that your company indemnifies them in potential lawsuits,
and
right?
Very broadly written.
Yeah, very broadly. Yes, that would be good lawyering.
Maybe I guess be clear about what an indemnification.
Yeah, sorry. Basically, that means that this company, if the Fortune 500 company in this case were sued for patent infringement based on the technology provided by your company,
right.
You would cover the legal fees. And did you want to answer?
I think that's a pretty common clause in a lot of deals, especially with big companies, and. Have you been successful in negotiating that away? I mean, that seems to be
no.
The...
Yeah.
Can I really quickly say that this is actually the biggest problem with those Lodestar cases where they went after the app developers? The app developers in those cases indemnified Apple, Google, et cetera, but Apple, Google don't indemnify their app developers. So this is... It's very important, I would say. I used to also bring private practice, so if I can put that hat on for a second, you should at least make sure that it's bilateral, that you are also indemnified. Right. And there, I mean, that's the bare minimum. I would never let anyone sign a contract that doesn't go
that
one way.
Yeah. But, and it kind of seems to be, some of the companies have already been sued by patent trolls, and those are the ones who are really, you know,
because it's expensive. It's a mess. And this is,
yeah,
I mean...
we've just closed.
Yeah, I mean, part of... This is really, I mean, as a practical matter, this is about your ability to negotiate the contract. But this is, I think, a serious problem with the system, that this is what you have to face. And I wish I could give you some kind of magic bullet, but
yeah. And I apologize for all the questions if they're really specific. Just I cannot answer them. As,
yeah. I mean, I think it's probably hard. It sounds like you need
a lawyer.
Which, I mean, you know, here was, I should say, the sad thing about Jeff's case is that he couldn't afford a lawyer.
We have some, but it just goes back and forth like it's...
That's right.
I mean, that situation really comes down to a negotiation between you and them. And, I mean, if your product is good and valuable to them, they should be willing to negotiate that aspect, right?
Most are, but...
Right. And some companies are just not, I mean, their heads are in the sand, so there's not a lot you can do.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure. Thank you.
My name is Mark Hodes, and I am a patent owner. And if I knowingly do not notify somebody that's infringing, then that invalidates my patent. How do you guys feel about mitigating arbitration to solve these issues?
Well, I don't think that's accurate that if you don't notify, it invalidates the patent. I think it just means that you can't get willful infringement damages, which is sort of a bigger class of damages. And just generally, I think arbitration and mitigation are a good way to resolve a dispute before it gets to full-blown litigation.
I would agree. Right? I mean, arbitration, if anyone's been involved in arbitration, it's kind of like litigation light. It tends to be cheaper and more efficient. And, I mean, I prefer that these patents never get litigated at all, but to the extent they are, I would always prefer that, you know, it happens in arbitration or mediation, allowing the parties. That's a much more civilized way to do things.
Support arbitration and mediation.
Hi. I was wondering, Ruben, if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit more about the other types of IP protection that are available to startups, such as trade secrets, copyright, things that involve risk to the patent applications, because software patents oftentimes don't issue. What
right.
you've done is spend a lot of money to tell everybody in the world how you do what you're doing, and then you walk away 3 years later with no patent at all.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And I think this really depends on the type of business you have. So copyright itself, I think, doesn't provide a lot of protection for an idea. Because copyright really, and I think Julie deals with more copyright than I do, but it really only covers the actual physical code that you've written. So someone has to actually copy your code pretty identically for copyright to be something you can use against them. Trade secret, though, I think is actually very powerful for a lot of startups, especially if you're dealing with sort of a startup that deals with a lot of data and you have like a particular algorithm that's really useful and your algorithm is just so much better than everybody else's. I mean, yeah, you could patent the broad idea, but your secret sauce is your algorithm. Keep that close to heart. No one can just copy that because they don't know it. And I'm using algorithm as like a broad term here for any sort of secret sauce that you can easily keep as a secret. The important thing about a trade secret, though, is you have to actually keep it secret. Keep it close to heart within the company. Make sure you have NDA signed with everybody who has access to it. And if it ever does accidentally leak out, claw it back as soon as possible so that you can maintain trade secret protection over it. Julie, do you have anything to add?
The only thing I would say, I agree with what Ruben said there. And, you know, copyright was protecting code before there were software patents. So that's been around for a while. It's really not that useful if you're looking for protection. But when you think about trade secret, I think that's a good example of why parties don't always need patents. And I mean, look at Google, right? Google until recently was not a big patent owner at all and grew its business without patents. And
in fact, they've just kept their algorithms secret. That's right. Really been the way they've done it.
And I think that's instructive. And Google's, you know, far from the only, I mean, there are tons of companies who've grown their business without having a whole bunch of patents. Google, Twitter, and you know, the other thing we were talking about yesterday, one great example of the types of businesses that have flourished without patents are all the rewards programs for your credit cards, your hotels, your, you know, airlines or whatever. Everyone does those rewards programs. That's great. That's good for consumers. It's, I believe, good for all the businesses that use them. I think that we largely all benefit from that. But if someone had patented that idea, either had it been in software, just a straight-up business method patent, you know, maybe United did it first. I don't know who did it first. They'd be the only ones who were able to do that now. And think about that world for a second. And that's a problem. There's also one other...
Think about all those upgrades you wouldn't be able to get.
One other point I think that's important to make on the practical piece that didn't get made earlier, and it's that, let's say you invent something. You have some great software with some great functionality. You believe it's totally novel, and you're really excited about it. Well, if you do that publicly and you know, make sure that you document things and make a little bit of noise, then no one else is going to be able to patent it either.
It's a very good point.
It's not quite so simple, but essentially, once something is public, no one else can get a patent on it. So if you are in a position where you want to make sure that you've got this idea, the next rapid rewards or whatever, the next point system, and you want to dedicate that to society, the best way might be to do it publicly and make sure no one else can patent it either. And the last little piece on that is there are a lot of issues like this that are particular to open source community. I'm happy to talk about them, but the patent troll and the software patent world has really disproportionately harmed the open source community, which is really unfortunate because the open source community has been such a driving force behind innovation in the past, you know, decade or two. But anyway, next question.
So the question I have is kind of a follow-up to what you were just saying about, you know, making your product public, you know, if it's super innovative and all this. Well, I compete in a space where there are a lot of companies doing the same thing I'm doing, but I'm doing it differently than they are. But I wouldn't necessarily say it's like super revolutionary or innovative or anything like that. So what should a company do in a case like that where, you know, they don't want one of these big guys with, you know, deep pockets going and building the same thing they've already built?
This is a really good question. And I think we have this kind of knee-jerk reaction in America that we should patent everything. Like, you should get a patent on that difference. But oftentimes, you don't need a patent to be better. Maybe what you need to be better is branding, or maybe it's customer service, or maybe it's all of these other components of your business that Ruben had in that earlier slide, and that might be what sets you apart. So instead of taking the money and the time and the effort to build those parts of your business, you should take and build those parts of your business instead of dumping all of those resources into, frankly, lawyers' fees to get a patent. And because here's the other thing. Just owning the patent isn't enough. You also have to pay to assert it, right? You need to hire a lawyer to send out the threatening letters. If you want people to believe your threatening letters have any teeth, you might end up in court. So it's not like you can just get the patent and then hold this piece of paper and say, okay, game over. I mean, right. So I think it's important to take a step back and, you know, holistically look at your business. And I think in many of those instances, you'll find out that that getting the patent in that case isn't the best bang for your buck.
You know, last time we were talking about Kickstarter and how there had been a company, what was it,
Indiegogo.
Indiegogo was doing the same thing first, but they didn't do it as well. And so there is something you said to just really executing your idea well and maybe better customer service. I don't know, that obviously that makes a difference, it seems like.
And one follow-up to what Julie was saying, if you have a company and you don't think there's anything that's particularly novel, but you want to, or you don't want to patent, or you just want to get an idea out there and just make sure it's out there so other people don't patent it, if you're going to do that, make sure you put it out there in as much, in enough detail to describe what it is that makes you different so that no one else can get a patent on it without, you know, revealing any trade secrets that you want to keep.
Perfect. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
It's a great panel.
Thanks.
The question I had is around what may be kind of an urban myth, I'm not sure, it's about eBay and how they have a
patent on a lot of things like that. They're really trying to have a patent on the checkout system for e-commerce. And really, my question is not so much about that specifically, but more about how is the patent office today with software patents where they were in the 90s as far as, you know, doing good examinations, granting good patents on things that are actually novel.
Good question.
That's a good question. I would say they're better, and I'm not sure I'd go into any more details than that. But
you know, I think traditionally the patent office, a lot of the folks who've come up through the patent office, the examiners and the policy people, they weren't fans of software patents. The people I've spoken to there did not think software patents were necessarily a good idea, but they have to grant them because the Supreme Court and Congress, or Supreme Court says so. So, I think to some extent they've gotten better because they have had more experience, but I think there's a lot of evidence that we're still seeing a lot of crappy patents, and I think that's a quality problem, and the quality problem is huge, and it's particularly bad with software patents. In other industries, again, in pharmaceuticals, there are certain terms in patent claims that start to take on consistent meanings. And that could literally be about, like the word, there are cases about the word about. But they start to have the same meaning in certain areas in which scientists, inventors practice. And software really lacks that consistency, and that's the problem. So I might write a bunch of patent claims, and then Ruben might write a bunch of patent claims, and they might use some of the same words, but in my patent, for some reason, they mean something different than Ruben's patent, which leaves the rest of you who go to read our patents totally and utterly confused.
I was a little bit late to this now. I didn't know if you walked through the process of getting that ready.
No, we didn't, but I could give you a five-second thing. One thing, though, on follow-up to your question, the other quality issue is that, like any other organization, the patent office is made up of a bunch of individuals, and you can get some solid examiners who are really into their job, and you can get some examiners who are quitting next week and really don't care anymore. So real quick, the process of getting a patent is you form an application, and the fees I showed earlier, I think there was a disconnect between me and Julie. Those were just the fees for preparing an application, not for getting a patent all the way to issuance. So first you prepare an application, and you file it in the patent office. You can do what's called a provisional application, which is to secure the priority date without paying as much of the amount of fees. But the provisional application needs to be as detailed as a real utility application would be.
Why don't you explain the priority date?
The priority date. So the priority date is the date you get to get around prior art, which is stuff that existed before your invention, right? And so if you file a provisional application, you get a priority date from one day before that, and one year before the date you file your provisional application. And same thing for filing a utility application, except the utility application, if it's filed with a provisional application, you can get the date that the provisional application was entitled to. And if you have further questions about this, you can come up afterwards. And then it sits there for a few years, and you get an office action, which is a response saying, hey, you've been rejected. Fix this, or you know, your patent's invalid because of this or this or that. Then you respond, and it's basically back and forth. It can be back and forth for as long as the attorney's prosecuting your application and the examiner wants. And then when the claims are amended to be in a fashion that is allowable, the patent issues.
And what I've seen in practice is that if you or you have enough money to pay a lawyer to throw at the patent office for long enough, you'll eventually end up with some kind of patent. Some people give up because it's a slog and it can take years and you could be out of business, you know, and yeah. Still prosecuting your patent.
I mean, I actually heard from background from people in the patent office that Intellectual Ventures kind of bullied them into, they didn't use those words, but that was the sense I got, you know, that they just kept pushing and pushing and pushing until the office said yes.
Thanks.
Sure.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for being here. I have a question. We're in a unique industry where anyone in the world can access our websites and find which I'm involved in. What are the international implications for a hack? I get one here in America. What happens in Venezuela? What happens in the European Union? Do you mind commenting on that?
So one thing about patents is if you get a patent in the U.S., it only applies in the U.S. You can't apply it anywhere else. It's totally territorial, and it's the same in every other country, except Europe has their European patent system rather than individual countries. One One thing to think about internationally, if you want to enforce a patent internationally, you have to apply for a patent internationally. And most international countries have a different view on applying for a patent in the U.S. In the U.S., you can apply for a patent even if you've already put your invention out there. You have what's called a one-year grace period. So if you launch your product on Friday, and then 2 months from now you're like, hey, maybe we should get a patent on that. That's okay in the U.S. In a lot of foreign countries, that's actually not okay. You have to file first before you make any sort of disclosure.
So. Can another company in another country sue you in their own country and you actually have to...
Yep.
Yeah. But you'd have to have some sort of presence there for them to actually sue you. I mean, they could file a suit in Kuala Lumpur, but if you're never in Kuala Lumpur and don't do business in Kuala Lumpur, doesn't...
How would you define your business if your website can be accessed?
Question.
It's actually kind of a complicated question.
Yeah, I
can't really give you. You need to talk to a lawyer on that one. Sorry.
Yeah. If that ever comes up, that it's a case by case determination on the country and the issues there. I mean, maybe they'll block your IP or something like that within that country. Or I mean, it's really open possibilities.
You know, one other quick thing that tangentially related to that I think is important. I mean, in almost every case, you're going to get a letter before a lawsuit. And so I think that's something to keep in mind, like the levels of risk that your company might be willing to kind of take. There usually is a process to these things, and you get a letter. They might ask you for a license. You might say, hey, we'll just get out of this country at that point. I don't know. I mean, these are things you have to think about with your business and with your own lawyer. But it's rare that you'll be just dragged into court first with no prior warning.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a really depressing answer, so I'll let you go.
You have a very depressing answer?
Yeah.
It's a very difficult question, because I don't want to say, like, don't worry about it. But at the same time, if you want to be successful in business, you can't really worry about it, right? Like, I wouldn't go out of your way to copy other people's devices. But if you're a company, establish yourself as an incorporated entity to limit your liability, to avoid, you know, risk to you. And I think... if you want to be successful in business, you have to go ahead and just run with your idea and just realize that there are risks associated with that.
Build it and they will come, and that includes the patent trolls.
That was my depressing answer, I guess. Yeah. I mean, you can hire a lawyer, and a lawyer can do a search, and that's helpful, and it could be helpful down the road for a whole host of other legal reasons, but because software patents are such a train wreck and because they're so hard to understand and so vague, there's always going to be some crazy patent lurking out there that someone can assert you're maybe infringing, and they're going to ask you for a licensing fee that's less than litigating it if you're successful, right? And this is this tax on innovation I was talking about. And it's incredibly unfortunate, because if they can ask you for less than litigation, you're most likely, if you're a rational business person, going to just pay up. Because who wants to waste all... I mean, going to court's a nightmare. So right now, we have a problem in this country because of that, and it's bad.
Thank you.
But you should still start businesses, by the way. And you should still innovate.
Go for it.
No one should be discouraged to start their business because of, like, the threat of patent litigation. Like, again, going to that slide with all the issues up there, there's a lot of stuff that contributes to success of your business, and patent litigation should not keep you up at night.
I'm actually a patent attorney. I've been practicing for 10 years, and I was a software developer before going to law school. And it's amazing here, you know, I think there's a lot of things that startups can do very cheap. And at the patent office, the fees are much lower for, you know, small entities. Mm-hmm. And to get an opinion of counsel is like, you know, $1,000 to see if something can be patented. But it's interesting here that there's so many people that think that it's not even worth, you know, considering. And, you know, the Facebook had 130 patents, I read this morning. Yahoo had, you know, 3,300 or something. So why is it that the startups, they just feel like it's not important, or, you know, they don't think about it?
So I think, you know, when I talk to friends or colleagues or whatever at startups, you know, their budgets are so constrained that $1,000 for the opinion oftentimes is $1,000 that could be spent on something else the business really needs. And, you know, at the startup, a lot of the startup is a crapshoot, and it's unclear what's going to happen with the business, and the patent application can take years, and it just seems like kind of a risky thing. And the last thing I'll add to that, going back to the clips, especially from Laura's piece, is a lot of software engineers don't want patents. They don't like patents. They don't want to think about patents. They don't want to talk to lawyers. They want to be working on their product.
They're busy starting their businesses. It is not, you know, if you have an idea and you're passionate and excited about your idea, it's not the first thing on your mind, and you're working long hours and, you know, trying to start your business. I think that's the answer I've gotten from actual entrepreneurs.
Yeah, it's just really interesting. But, you know, very recently the patent office came out with something where you can get a patent very quickly. It's like a 12-track-1 application.
So yeah,
you pay a little bit more money.
But that costs more money, which is what startups don't have.
Exactly. But it was just interesting that, you know, the response that you get from the people here. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
And I think investors also have a big influence on that. Cause like I said, again, some really want patents. Yeah. Some don't want you to spend their money on patents. So,
yeah, I think a lot of times you'll have a startup and it'll be the engineers and the people starting the business, and then they'll maybe bring in a new CEO when they start getting big, and that CEO will be like, holy, you guys don't have any patents?
I think we're just about out of time, but we have like another question here.
Take this last question, and we'll stick around for questions.
Sure, there's two questions I have. Number one, New Patent Act, American Invents Act, just came out.
Yeah.
Before that, about 90, I think, if somebody filed a patent lawsuit or whatever, and somebody challenged it in the patent office, they could file a re-exam request.
Right.
And there was over 95% of those were granted.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For the patent office to reconsider.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that changing under the way the new act is?
So the process will be slightly different, but there are still re-exam procedures that'll be, some will be similar, some will be different. There's also this post-grant or post-issuance where a third party can object to a patent, but Congress totally screwed that up because they made it just 90 days. So, you know, patents issued, and then you've got 90 days to object, but if you miss the window, you can't do that anymore. So the process is going to change. A lot of lawyers who are going to figure out how these changes work are going to make a whole bunch of money. But
and that's the second question. What was EFF's position on the new Patent Act? I mean, did you all lobby for certain things?
So the new Patent Act was pending in some form or another for about 5 or 6 years. Earlier versions were better. This version was like, what a waste of time. It didn't really fix. There were a couple tiny fixes, and there are a couple interesting things coming out of it, and we're working to make sure that's implemented in a good way. But really, it's unfortunate that it took Congress like 50 or 60 years to pass substantive patent reform, and it did almost nothing. And it's depressing because we probably won't come back to it again for a while in Congress because of that, and it's too bad because these issues, if you guys follow, you know, these tech issues, the software patent issues, they're everywhere lately, in no small part to Laura. And it's unfortunate that momentum is going to, you know, stop at the front door of the Capitol.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
And please rate this panel.